So first, my disclosure is that I have nothing to disclose except to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for funding the Network for Public Health Law, under which hat I am presenting here today. Our fearless leader is blowing his nose in the back of the room downstairs. And my friend up here, Doug Farquhar from the NCSL, because I have a slide from y'all on here, so I wanted to acknowledge it was from Jackie's presentation at our regional event. So I'm just going to do a brief overview of the more traditional state regulations related to fracking, and then talk about some of the non-traditional legal issues that arise that public health professionals and lawyers should be thinking about if they're working in this particular area, or really any environmental area. So, you know, as Heather made clear, states have responded quite differently throughout the shale, and courtesy of NCSL, at least 125 bills in 19 states considered during this legislative session, meaning kind of during the last 12 months, that specifically address hydraulic fracturing. So, you know, pretty much almost where you live, if you live on the eastern seaboard or if you live in the middle of the country, you've had some legislation related to hydrofracturing introduced. They fall into a bunch of different categories. I'm going to cover a couple of them here today. Moratoria or bans, and what's the difference? A moratorium is typically considered a temporary stay, right? So temporarily, we're not going to permit this particular activity while we XYZ. In this particular circumstance, I use Maryland as the example, my home state, which is currently underwater. I'm not worrying about it or anything. I'm not going to get home until God knows when, but don't worry, I'm fine. I'm not wondering when the travel agent is calling me to say when I can get home. In any case, so I've totally lost my train of thought. But Maryland imposed a moratorium by executive order, meaning the governor, when legislation failed to pass, the governor stepped in and said, nope, we're not going to allow hydrofracturing in the state of Maryland until X date. The X date is actually coincides with the end of his tenure as governor, so there's always the issue with an executive order that it expires at the expiration, technically. I mean, it will stay in place unless the new governor can come in and make changes pretty rapidly. But the whole goal of this moratorium is to allow for the state to create a commission that would then study the potential positive and negative impacts of hydrofracturing, both on the environment and on humans. Unfortunately, the commission has no money to do its work and has done one of its three mandatory reports. So we do expect legislation to be introduced. Our new session will begin January 2013 to institute a ban until those issues can be resolved, simply because of the fear that a turnover in the governorship or the like will do away with the executive order. But as Heather noted, a ban is a more permanent, we don't want this business going on in our state, and Vermont is the only state that has passed a ban. Ingredient disclosure or chemical disclosure, I was wearing my other public health hat, my food policy hat. Chemical disclosure laws are seen popped up, are being considered around the country, and many are getting passed. And this is, you know, kind of your basic environmental regulation that says, at least let us know what you're using so that scientists can do further study on the health impacts, so that physicians who are treating patients that might be made ill from this process can understand, so that employees who are subject to these particular hazards know what they're being subject to. And these take a variety of different approaches. I'd use Pennsylvania as the example, in part because it's subject to litigation right now. So in Pennsylvania, state law requires chemical disclosure after the frack. Thanks, Carrie. Because I built in time into my presentation for laughter. If it doesn't come, I'll be done early. In any case, but the one of the important issues for the Pennsylvania law is it provides really strong protections for trade secrets, written pretty broadly. So while, you know, there is some chemical disclosure query whether it's effective, particularly for researchers, because quantities aren't required. If they don't know what chemicals they got from the chemical companies in their compound, they don't have to disclose. But the issue subject to litigation right now is that there's an exception even for the trade secret protections that the companies should have to share broader information with physicians who are treating someone who has been exposed potentially to the fracking fluid or the hazards of presented by fracking. But the physicians have to sign a confidentiality agreement that is pretty rigorous. And so there is a physician in Pennsylvania who has filed litigation alleging that it interferes with the patient-provider relationship. It's obviously not good for public health, because if he's limited to treating this one patient who has presented with this one issue and can only use this information for that one patient, yet he knows a community, a family, has been exposed, the physicians are feeling overly constrained with this law. So that's just one of the examples of where a law might sound, oh, it's great, Pennsylvania has, you know, a chemical disclosure law, but when you pull back the curtain, you see that it may not be the best example of a solid public health chemical disclosure provision. The federal government did, somewhat recently under the Obama administration, do a bit less than public health or environmental advocates would have liked, but did impose some chemical disclosure requirements now that apply countrywide. Other state legislative activity, what I'll call process regulation, regulations associated with the process and how it can be undertaken, a variety of different ways, how the well casing has to be built, how far back from homes or other zoning areas the wells need to be placed, how far apart they need to be placed from each other, and wastewater regulation. A lot of activity in the wastewater regulation. So kind of a update here to the New Jersey law actually did pass. The state legislature passed a law prohibiting the discharge of fracking wastewater in the state, because there is no public wastewater treatment facility that can actually appropriately treat and release back into the environment fracking wastewater. So the legislature did pass that provision. However, Governor Christie vetoed it. They have not taken up the veto override. Numbers on passage actually indicated that an override could be possible, but voting for a bill, crossing party lines, versus overriding a veto that your party has put into place are two different political matters. So I have no guess on what will happen there. Another area of activity in legislation that we see here is impact fees or severance taxes. So a great number of states are thinking, well, okay, let's let it happen and make cash on it. And so we start to see a lot of states, well, they've already had severance taxes in place, either increasing the severance tax, particularly associated with hydrofracturing, or making sure that the severance tax is applied to hydrofracturing. But we also see, and again, you see an example here from Pennsylvania, where they recently imposed a $50,000 per well fee. That's what it is for 2012. It will be adjusted annually based on natural gas prices and the consumer price index. So we do see the states that are allowing fracking at least trying to get a bit of money out of it. So, but here's really to the what I think are the more difficult to think about and probably not thought about by a lot of environmental or public health professionals and certainly lawyers who are working who want to improve public health from the perspective of exposure to fracturing. So I'm going to try to not be too lawyerly about this. The rule of capture. And so this is how it was defined in 1935. So the owner of a tract of land acquires title to the oil and gas which he produces from wells drilled thereon, though it may be proved that part of such oil and gas migrated from adjoining lands. Meaning, if I drill on my property, and as a result of that drilling, gas from your property or oil from your property comes up through my well, it's mine. Finders keepers. So the principle as applied in case law, basically this is a Pennsylvania case, but it could almost come from any state where the common law principle of rule of capture applied, that if, you know, regardless of where you are, if you're able to tap into and get someone else's minerals out of their property, again, they're yours. So this rule is a common law rule that can and has been in many states changed by state law. And so you can see some examples here. The network is about to produce a series of documents about the rule of capture and what's called forced pooling that will give more depth to this here. But just so you understand, there are state laws that have changed the rule of capture. So in New York, if you participate in this what's called forced pooling and your property is among some that are going to be subject to the drilling, you will automatically get at least a 1/8 revenue or 1/8 share of the revenue from that unit. How much you have to pay for the cost of drilling the unit varies by whether you're a voluntary forced pulling person or whether you're a compelled forced pulling person, whether you're in New York, Maryland, Virginia, et cetera. But by and large, the state laws do provide for if you're going to be forced to allow the minerals under your property to be extracted, you should at least get something. And the state set a standard for what that is. But it's really important to know whether the state law actually provides for some sort of forced pooling, some sort of mandatory royalty, because some state laws, like West Virginia's, looks like it is changing the rule of capture, but it doesn't. It sets up an optional pooling scenario. So a landowner who may not want to allow extraction from his or her property may nevertheless have gas or oil extracted from his property. Why is this important for public health? Well, if people who own property and are trying to protect their property and their community more broadly from the vagaries that might be associated with hydrofracturing, they need to understand their property rights, whether they could be part of stopping a forced pooling. Does the law allow for the community to object at a certain level so that the forced pooling can't occur? Or is this something that you might seek to change at your state level so that you do have, even states that politically might be inclined to allow fracturing might also be politically more likely to allow you to control access to your own property, right? Property rights for those individuals or that you know, political persuasion of some sort might be more profound. So this is why this is important to public health. When we look at forced pooling statutes, these are the what we want to look at in the forced pooling statute to see how it would apply to a particular landowner. When do you have to play? How broad is the land? If the well is going to be dropped here, how wide around does the forced pooling go? How far can the drilling occur? It occurs under the surface. They're not able to come to your surface, but they can go in and under to your surface. And so how far around does that go? Is there an objection that if a certain percentage of the landowners object, that will stop the activity? Typically, there are very detailed procedures for a hearing notice to all property owners, as well as what state agency will decide the particular matter. And again, what's most important is that at least landowners are paid some royalty. Even if they objected to it, they're entitled to a statutory royalty. So another issue that arises for individuals dealing with this in their particular community are leasing issues. And so I give kudos to the Maryland Attorney General's office. They have two really great documents that I think could be adapted for most other jurisdictions. So if an individual is in a community where hydrofracturing is going to occur, and some people will decide that while they may not want it to occur, it's going to occur, and their minerals will be taken whether they like it or not, they may as well allow a well on their property so that they can make some of the money. And this is some of the economic benefits that we talk about. To be frank, we're talking about communities that are suffering. They're suffering tremendously from the economic downturn. In Maryland, it's our very rural communities where the rural poor are getting poorer and have less resources in their communities to assist them. And so there is an attraction to these lease opportunities. At least let's have those consumers, those landowners, be educated about what their rights are when they're executing these leases. And so some of the tips here are just designed to make sure that the property owner is understanding what his or her rights are and not giving away more than has to be given away. So obviously the most primary of all is read the document and understand it, and the next line should say, and if you don't, get a lawyer who can help you, because honestly these are not arm's length transactions. There is a definite imbalance of power here between the fracking companies and the individuals. And so then you can see some of the other specifics about trees. If they take away the trees and they make money on selling that timber, it's your money. They have to give it to you. Those were your trees. Be clear about what the term of the contract is. A lot of these contracts have really confusing terms that make you realize only after the fact that there's automatic renewal that you can't object to. And so these are just some of the tips that we want to make sure that people really understand when they're signing a contract. I'm actually going to skip quickly through the dormant mineral interest because I'm running out of time. But this is just to be aware of whether a surface owner owns the mineral rights, they actually can be separate estates, so the surface can be owned by one person and what's underneath be owned by another individual. It's important for someone who's going to allow hydrofracturing on their property to know whether there's someone who owns the mineral rights, because they may have obligations to give the money to the mineral rights owners. But most states, or a lot of states actually, allow for termination of mineral rights if they've been abandoned. So if you don't even know who would own those, they've never made a claim, there's a process by which you can have the courts deem that mineral interest abandoned, and you don't have to worry about that particular issue. And lastly, from a consumer protection perspective, and this is really using an existing established kind of legal principle of making sure that consumers, in this case the landowners, who are executing the leases, understand what they're actually signing. So because this is me stepping a little bit out of whatever, I'm not Heather, so I can do this. You know, the oil and gas companies come in and promise you sunshine and roses and unicorns, and then they leave and your land looks just like it did after they were strip mined for other purposes. And the fact of the matter is, people want to believe in the unicorns. We all want to believe in the unicorns because there's money to be made by that, and they don't want to have believed that they did something that was harmful to the environment, to their own communities. So it's really important. And so some organizations have sought to have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau take action to, because there's no agency who's helping consumers, leaseholders be aware, property owners be aware of what the real impacts are. So at least they're making educated decisions when they're making them, so you can see what the request has been made. So the bottom line is that there are just innumerable laws that can and do have an impact on whether hydrofracturing is going to be allowed in a community, and public health professionals don't have to know everything about those laws, should know, as I think Jessica was really pointing out, that they exist and how to find someone to help you walk through them. It may be a potential way for a community to stop fracking in their neighborhood. There you go.